Chapter 25. Most people, and more honest than people who have the use of their eyes. The goods they make are readily saleable. People like them. And so they are supporting themselves, and it is a matter of cheer. They pass their time now not too irksomely as they formerly did. What this association needs and wants is $15,000. The figures are set down, and what the money is for, and there is no graft in it or I would not be here. And they hope to beguile that out of your pockets, and you will find a fix to the program and opportunity, that little blank which you will fill out and promise, so much money now, or tomorrow or some time. Then, there is another opportunity which is still better, and that is that you shall subscribe an annual sum. I have invented a good many useful things in my time, but never anything better than that of getting money out of people who don't want to part with it. It is always for good objects, of course. This is the plan. When you call upon a person to contribute to a great and good object, and you think he should furnish about $1,000, he disappoints you, as like as not. Much the best way to work him to supply that $1,000 is to split it in two parts and contribute, say $100 a year, or 50, or whatever the sum may be. Let him contribute 10 or 20 a year. He doesn't feel that, but he does feel it when you call upon him to contribute a large amount. When you get used to it, you would rather contribute than borrow money. I tried it in Helen Keller's case. Mr. Hutton wrote me in 1896 or 1897, when I was in London, and said, "Colin, the gentleman who has been so liberal in taking care of Helen Keller, has died without making provision for her in his will, and now they don't know what to do." They were proposing to raise a fund, and he thought $50,000 enough to furnish an income of $2,400, or $2,500 a year for the support of that wonderful girl and her wonderful teacher, Miss Sullivan, now Mrs. Macy. I wrote to Mr. Hutton and said, "Go on, get up your fund. It will be slow, but if you want quick work, I propose this system, the system I speak of asking people to contribute such and such a sum from year to year and drop out whenever they please, and he would find there wouldn't be any difficulty, people wouldn't feel the burden of it." And he wrote back saying he had raised the $2,400 a year indefinitely by that system in a single afternoon. "We would like to do something just like that tonight. We will take as many checks as you care to give. You can leave your donations in the big room outside." I knew once what it was to be blind. I shall never forget that experience. I have been as blind as anybody ever was for 3 or 4 hours, and the sufferings that I endured, and the mishaps and the accidents that are burning in my memory make my sympathy rise, when I feel for the blind and always shall feel. I once went to Heidelberg on an excursion. I took a clergyman along with me, the Rev. Joseph Twitchell, of Hartford, who is still among the living despite that fact. I always travel with clergymen when I can. It is better for them, it is better for me. And any preacher who goes out with me in stormy weather, and without a lightning rod, is a good one. The Reverend Twitchell is one of those people filled with patience and endurance, two good ingredients for a man traveling with me, so we got along very well together. In that old town they have not altered a house, nor built one in 1500 years. We went to the inn, and they placed Twitchell and me in a most colossal bedroom, the largest I ever saw or heard of. It was as big as this room. I didn't take much notice of the place. I didn't really get my bearings. I noticed Twitchell got a German bed about 2 feet wide, the kind in which you've got to lie on your edge, because there isn't room to lie on your back, and he was way down south in that big room, and I was way up north at the other end of it, with a regular Sahara in between. We went to bed. Twitchell went to sleep, but then he had his conscience loaded, and it was easy for him to get to sleep. I couldn't get to sleep. It was one of those torturing kinds of lovely summer nights, when you hear various kinds of noises now and then. A mouse away off in the southwest. You throw things at the mouse. That encourages the mouse. But I couldn't stand it, and about 2 o'clock I got up, and thought I would give it up, and go out in the square, where there was one of those tinkling fountains, and sit on its brink and dream, full of romance. I got out of bed, and I ought to have lit a candle, but I didn't think of it until it was too late. It was the darkest place that ever was. There has never been darkness any thicker than that. It just lay in cakes. I thought that, before dressing I would accumulate my clothes. I pawed around in the dark, and found everything packed together on the floor except one sock. I couldn't get on the track of that sock. It might have occurred to me that maybe it was in the wash. But I didn't think of that. I went excursioning on my hands and knees. Presently I thought, I am never going to find it. I'll go back to bed again. That is what I tried to do during the next 3 hours. I had lost the bearings of that bed. I was going in the wrong direction all the time. By and by I came in collision with a chair and that encouraged me. It seemed to me, as far as I could recollect, there was only a chair here and there and yonder, 5 or 6 of them scattered over this territory, and I thought maybe, after I found that chair I might find the next one. Well, I did. And I found another and another and another. I kept going around on my hands and knees, having those sudden collisions, and finally when I banged into another chair I almost lost my temper. And I raised up, garbed as I was, not for public exhibition, right in front of a mirror 15 or 16 feet high. I hadn't noticed the mirror, didn't know it was there. And when I saw myself in the mirror I was frightened out of my wits. I don't allow any ghosts to bite me, and I took up a chair and smashed at it. 1,000,000 pieces. Then I reflected. That's the way I always do, and it's unprofitable, unless a man has had much experience, that way and has clear judgment. And I had judgment, and I would have had to pay for that mirror if I hadn't recollected to say it was Twitchell who broke it. Then I got down, on my hands and knees, and went on another exploring expedition. As far as I could remember there were 6 chairs in that Oklahoma, and 1 table, a great big heavy table, not a good table to hit with your head when rushing madly along. In the course of time I collided with 35 chairs and tables enough to stock that dining room out there. It was a hospital for decayed furniture, and it was in a worse condition when I got through with it. I went on, and at last, got to a place where I could feel my way up, and there was a shelf. I knew that wasn't in the middle of the room. Up to that time I was afraid I had gotten out of the city. I was very careful and pawed along that shelf, and there was a pitcher of water about a foot high, and it was at the head of Twitchell's bed, but I didn't know it. I felt that pitcher going and I grabbed at it, but it didn't help any, and came right down in Twitchell's face and nearly drowned him. But it woke him up. I was grateful to have company on any terms. He lit a match, and there I was, way down south when I ought to have been back up yonder. My bed was out of sight, it was so far away. You needed a telescope to find it. Twitchell comforted me, and I scrubbed him off, and we got sociable. But that night wasn't wasted. I had my pedometer on my leg. Twitchell and I were in a pedometer match. Twitchell had longer legs than one. The only way I could keep up was to wear my pedometer to bed. I always walk in my sleep, and on this occasion I gained 16 miles on him. After all, I never found that sock. I never have seen it from that day to this. But that adventure taught me what it is to be blind. That was one of the most serious occasions of my whole life, yet I never can speak of it without somebody thinking it isn't serious. You try it, and see how serious it is to be as the blind are, and I was that night. Mr. Clemens read several letters of regret. He then introduced Joseph H. Choate, saying, "It is now my privilege to present to you Mr. Choate. I don't have to really introduce him. I don't have to praise him, or to flatter him. I could say truly that in the 47 years I have been familiarly acquainted with him, he has always been the handsomest man America has ever produced. And I hope and believe he will hold the belt 45 years more. He has served his country ably, faithfully, and brilliantly. He stands at the summit, at the very top in the esteem and regard of his countrymen, and if I could say one word which would lift him any higher in his countrymen's esteem and affection, I would say that word, whether it was true or not. Dr. Mark Twain, Pharmaceopath, address at the annual dinner of the New York Postgraduate Medical School and Hospital, January 21, 1909, the President, Dr. George N. Miller, in introducing Mr. Clemens, referred to his late experience with burglars. Gentlemen and doctors, I am glad to be among my own kind tonight. I was once a sharpshooter, but now I practice a much higher, and equally as deadly a profession. It wasn't so very long ago that I became a member of your cult, and for the time I've been in the business my record is one that can't be scoffed at. As to the burglars, I am perfectly familiar with these people. I have always had a good deal to do with burglars, not officially, but through their attentions to me. I never suffered anything at the hands of a burglar. They have invaded my house time and time again. They never got anything. Then those people who burglarized our house in September, we got back the plated ware they took off, we jailed them, and I have been sorry ever since. They did us a great service, they scared off all the servants in the place. I consider the Children's Theater, of which I am president, and the Postgraduate Medical School as the two greatest institutions in the country. This school, in bringing its 20,000 physicians from all parts of the country, bringing them up to date, and sending them back with renewed confidence, has surely saved hundreds of thousands of lives which otherwise would have been lost. I have been practicing now for 7 months. When I settled on my farm in Connecticut in June, I found the community very thinly settled, and since I have been engaged in practice it has become more thinly settled still. This gratifies me, as indicating that I am making an impression on my community. I suppose it is the same with all of you. I have always felt that I ought to do something for you, and so I organized a Reading, Connecticut, branch of the postgraduate school. I am only a country farmer up there, but I am doing the best I can. Of course, the practice of medicine and surgery in a remote country district has its disadvantages, but in my case I am happy in a division of responsibility. I practice in conjunction with a horse doctor, a sexton, and an undertaker. The combination is airtight, and once a man is stricken in our district, escape is impossible for him. These four of us, three in the regular profession, and the fourth an undertaker, are all good men. There is Bill Ferguson, the Reading undertaker. Bill is there in every respect. He is a little lukewarm on general practice, and writes his name with a rubber stamp. Like my old southern friend, he is one of the finest planters anywhere. Then there is Jim Ruggles, the horse doctor. Ruggles is one of the best men I have got. He also is not much on general medicine, but he is a fine horse doctor. Ferguson doesn't make any money off him. You see, the combination started this way. When I got up to Reading, and had become a doctor, I looked around to see what my chances were for aiding in the great work. The first thing I did was to determine what manner of doctor I was to be. Being a Connecticut farmer, I naturally consulted my pharmacopoeia, and at once decided to become a pharmaceopath. Then I got circulating about, and got in touch with Ferguson and Ruggles. Ferguson joined readily in my ideas, but Ruggles kept saying that, while it was all right for an undertaker to get aboard, he couldn't see where it helped horses. Well, we started to find out what was the trouble with the community, and it didn't take long to find out that there was just one disease, and that was race suicide. And driving about the countryside, I was told by my fellow farmers that it was the only rational human and valuable disease. But it is cutting into our profits, so that we'll either have to stop it or we'll have to move. We've had some funny experiences up there in Reading. Not long ago a fellow came along with a rolling gait and a distressed face. We asked him what was the matter. We always hold consultations on every case, as there isn't business enough for four. He said he didn't know, but that he was a sailor, and perhaps that might help us to give a diagnosis. We treated him for that, and I never saw a man die more peacefully. That same afternoon my dog Tige treated an African gentleman. We chained up the dog, and then the gentleman came down and said he had appendicitis. We asked him if he wanted to be cut open, and he said yes, that he'd like to know if there was anything in it. So we cut him open and found nothing in him but darkness. So we diagnosed his case as infidelity, because he was dark inside. Tige is a very clever dog, and aids us greatly. The other day a patient came to me, and inquired if I was old Dr. Clemens. As a practitioner I have given a great deal of my attention to Bright's disease. I have made some rules for treating it that may be valuable. Listen. Rule 1. When approaching the bedside of one whom an all-wise president, I mean an all-wise providence, well, anyway, it's the same thing, has seen fit to afflict with disease, well, the rule is simple, even if it is old-fashioned. Rule 2. I've forgotten just what it is, but, Rule 3. This is always indispensable. Bleed your patient. Missouri University Speech Address delivered June 4, 1902, at Columbia, Mo. When the name of Samuel 50, Clemens was called, the humorist stepped forward, put his hand to his hair, and apparently hesitated. There was a dead silence for a moment. Suddenly the entire audience rose and stood in silence. Someone began to spell out the word Miss Sauri with an interval between the letters. All joined in. Then the house again became silent. Mr. Clemens broke the spell. As you are all standing, he drawled in his characteristic voice, I suppose I had better stand too. Then came a laugh and loud cries for a speech. As the great humorist spoke of his recent visit to Hannibal, his old home, his voice trembled. You cannot know what a strain it was on my emotions, he said. In fact, when I found myself shaking hands with persons I had not seen for 50 years and looking into wrinkled faces that were so young and joyous when I last saw them, I experienced emotions that I had never expected and did not know were in me. I was profoundly moved and saddened to think that this was the last time, perhaps, that I would ever behold those kind old faces and dear old scenes of childhood. The humorist then changed to a lighter mood, and for a time the audience was in a continual roar of laughter. He was particularly amused at the eulogy on himself read by Gardiner Lathrop in conferring the degree. He has a fine opportunity to distinguish himself, said Mr. Clemens, by telling the truth about me. I have seen it stated in print that as a boy I had been guilty of stealing peaches, apples, and watermelons. I read a story to this effect very closely not long ago, and I was convinced of one thing, which was Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.